On this week's Big Tech Show, when will cars safely drive themselves on our streets? And who in Ireland is providing the technology to help them do that? We talk to one of the country's biggest automotive autonomy entrepreneurs.
I have BMW Drive Assist in my own vehicle, and it is much, much safer because we are all prone to distraction, especially when we're on the motorway from Limerick to Dublin, for example. We've all been there where you actually forgot a whole section of the road. So I would say if you take it from a safety perspective, and it does allow you to kind of relax.
The Big Tech Show, available on all podcast platforms.
Seachtain, an Indo a scéalaige.
Táim i mbun iarrachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach anseo gur féidir é a chur in uaigh ceart lena bhaintear féin.
Scéaltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gCorna Meán an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthchar an reachtam. Iadach sé tarrin grúvan ar cárstan I lis dúhal agus gimine fnacht gór a clig sár ducas sin éachar. Nau ni vin aon dar darach sin, vin marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave, 1919, 1920. There's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
Previously on the Indo Daily, a gangland succession.
He was asked by the McCarthy Dundons a favour, and that favour was to murder a young mum, a mother of two little boys who lived in Swords, called Baiba Salute, you may recall. We start writing about it, and everybody knows Marlowe's involved. He said to him, "Look, Marlowe, this is all getting very, very complicated. You're in serious danger here, man." They came in the door and they found the young lad dead.
Marlowe Hyland's short-lived reign of terror proved just how unstable life can be at the top of the Irish underworld.
That was the moment Eamon Dunn becomes the third part of this story. He is the new boss of Marlowe Hyland's empire.
And once again, the betrayal of a former friend created a new opportunity for those seeking power.
The emergence of this guy, this was a whole new game.
But Eamon Dunn was a totally different fish to Marlowe and PJ Judge. More vicious and deranged than maybe anyone else who had ever come before him.
By the time this coup takes place, is already soaked in blood. He goes on to murder about 14, 15 people, including some of his close friends.
But Dunn's volatility made him a target in his own right.
He started having affairs with their partners, but then he started taking explicit pictures and circulating them to these guys and to their associates to humiliate them.
And his profile in organized crime would soon become too large, bringing heat not just on him, but everyone around him.
But when you start killing too many people, the old story is the police start getting involved. If you become a problem, you don't get your P45, you don't get sacked, you don't get moved off the board with a big handshake, you end up dead.
I'm Ellen Coyne, and today on the Indo Daily, we reach the finale of our Gangland Succession trilogy as I speak with Paul Williams, special correspondent with the Irish Independent, to discuss how one Irish godfather became so violent and disruptive, he slowly wrote his own demise. This is the story of Eamon the Don Dunn. So, Paul, introduce us to Eamon Dunn, this massive crime figure. Who was he?
I suppose, in a line, he was, without doubt, the most bloodstained, murderous gang boss we've ever seen in gangland, which is quite something to say. I know it would be challenged now or since then by Daniel Kinahan, but in the big, big picture over the past 40, 50 years, he stands out there because he was responsible for at least 15, 16 murders in the space of 4 years. he became so big, but also so dangerous and so paranoid and so volatile that he could order the murder of his best mate, which he did. Graham McNally was one of them. An unofficial committee came together, and I referred to in one of my books through the years as this committee, which was made up the likes of Christy Kinahan Sr., Jerry Hutch, the Monk, and other well-known luminaries in gangland. And they had to sit around away from prying ears and said, Eamon Dunne has become such a nuisance and such a liability, he's just going to have to go. The evidence is there that members of the Hutch gang, including Gary Hutch and senior players in the Kinahan gang, they carried out his murder because he was just too dangerous. And that, again, is one of the themes we've been looking at. You know, guy becomes very big. He becomes a liability both to the business and to the lives of other people, and he gets whacked.
It's such an interesting trajectory. And like you said, we've seen it before where someone kind of explodes onto the scene, becomes so big, so powerful, and then kind of becomes complicit in their own downfall. Talk to me about how people like yourself first started paying attention to him and how he crossed the guards' radar as well.
Well, he started emerging, as they all do, as a young criminal with a particularly violent streak. And at one stage, he was recruited and brought in under the embrace of Marlowe Hyland, we've talked about before, became the big boss when he had his boss whacked. And so Dunne was very much one of his most trusted lieutenants. And then, as we've talked about before, Marlowe Hyland becomes a major, major key player in the whole national infrastructure of organised crime in Ireland. And he's bringing in new measures to, you know, new business methods to bring people together so that different gangs work together and all the gangs work together and everybody, look, crimeinc.com, they're all going to work across and have agreements, and just like you see in some of the movies and the attempts that have been made before to get criminals to work together in like a grand coalition. And then Marlowe gets into a lot of trouble and he becomes targeted and his whole organization is targeted and the police are moving in against him all the time. So many of his shipments are seized, so many of his people are being put away. So people start talking, and this is affecting the Kinahan's business and all of that. And Eamon Dunne talks at the table and basically says, well, you know, I will take over because this is a problem. That's when he really does explode onto the crime scene, because he personally organised the murder of his boss, Marlowe Hyland. And he sent two members of the gang, two guys who are drug traffickers within the Marlowe gang, to kill Marlowe. In December of 2006, they went into this house and they shot Marlowe as he lay in bed, but they came down, and this is what really made this crime particularly shocking. They came down the stairs and saw young Anthony Campbell, who was a young plumber, trainee plumber, and they took a momentary decision. He has seen us. He knows us. We're going to have to kill him.
He was very, very young, only 20.
He was 20 years of age, yeah.
Had he been long in the plumbing business, or?
He's at the start of his apprenticeship. He just wanted it.
Yeah.
He said, I just want to be an apprentice plumber, you know?
Yeah.
He was actually let go of work, and this is an extra guy, you know, to do. Go out and earn a few quid for Christmas.
From that moment on, then, Eamon Dunne was the major player. And of course, by the way, Eamon Dunne was very much, if we backtrack less than a year earlier, to the murder of Bybe Saluta, an innocent mother of two little boys. She was murdered basically because of her personal life.
28-year-old Bybe Saluta was shot dead at the door of her home in Swords, County Dublin, on November the 19th, 2006. At the time, her husband, identified only as Mr. A at the tribunal, was waiting to be sentenced after pleading guilty to abducting their two children from the state. He was already in prison on other matters. Ms. Saluta prepared a victim impact statement saying she was very scared for her life. She was killed 5 days later. No one has ever been convicted of her murder.
She was totally innocent. The McCarthy Dundons from Limerick helped organise the murder on behalf of this person who wanted her dead. He reached out to Marlowe. Marlowe reached out to the rest of his organisation. Eamon Dunne was involved. And that murder as well was another turning point in the gangland story, because it was horrific. So Eamon Dunne, by the time this coup takes place, is already soaked in blood. But over the next few years, in the space of another less than 4 years, he goes on to murder about 14, 15 people, including some of his close friends, All of them would have been associates. One of them was a double murder organized by one of his hitmen. That hitman goes to Spain with the help of the Kinahans to hide out to go for rehab. He was a drug addict. He comes out of the rehab, and Eamon Dunne, with the help and the compliance of the Kinahans and Gary Hutch, take this guy, Christy Gilroy, away, murder him, and he's never been found. So to say that Eamon Dunne is perhaps one of the most blood-soaked gangsters in our criminal history is not exaggerating in any way.
And when you're describing there are times when, you know, he was involved in completely innocent people being killed just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time or crossing the wrong person's path, turning on his own boss, turning on some of his closest friends, at the time, would that have been striking? Like, would that have been very different to the mentality or modus operandi of other kind of criminals?
Well, I was covering crime very intensely at the time, and the emergence of this guy, this was a whole new game. And remember, at this stage, coming up 2010, we've had some of the worst years of what went on in Limerick with the McCarthy Dundas. We also had a gang war in Finglas, which was not associated with him. We had the Crumlin and Drimna feud. We'd never seen anything like this guy before. And it really did epitomise the new culture of organised crime, even much worse than Marlow Hyland, and even much worse again than PJ Judge, who was the other godfather. I put the nickname on him, the Don, because his name is Dunne. It was a play on Dunne, and it was a gangland-type term we used for him. He also was very similar to some of these really out-of-control thugs you see and portrayed in movies. What he started doing was not only did he have his own enemies that he whacked and got out of the way, but he made other enemies. Like what he used to do was a number of his associates who had ended up in prison and he'd fallen out with, he started having affairs with their partners. But then he started taking explicit pictures and circulating them to these guys and to their associates to humiliate them. This guy took it four steps further than anybody else. He'd walk in, meet one of his underlings with a girlfriend and say, you know, she's going to be mine. And I'm not exaggerating. But cops themselves would express their absolute shock and revulsion at him, but also total sort of, God, we've never seen anything like this before, even though we thought we'd seen it all. He was just one walking, talking murder machine. After he had his best friend, one of his best friends, Graham McNally, murdered, I remember ringing him one day. In 2009, I got his number and he went bananas. But very typically, like a lot of these criminals, like Marlow Hyland before and PJ Judge. PJ Judge wanted to murder me because I exposed him. Marlow Hyland sued me several occasions. And this guy, they all feel sorry for themselves. He was crossing all the lines. And what happens is that then this confluence of anger and frustration and fear comes together and the criminals get rid of him. And that's why he was murdered, because they just couldn't handle him anymore. And even though he was brilliant for business, he was brilliant for business for a while. But remember, it was all about the flow of cocaine, particularly into the marketplace, which was then starting to boom. And the guys in Spain were getting pissed off. Christy Kinahan and his son Daniel, and then they're all their associates. But they were all one big gang. This is prior to the Regency conflagration. And they're saying, he's attracting attention on us that we don't need.
There was one story about one of his victims, which people might remember, John Daly, who attracted a lot of attention when he called into to Liveline from prison.
This is way back in 2007. I was on arguing with some other person about something to do with crime on Liveline, and he rang in from Portlaoise.
Okay. Yeah, John Daly's on the line. John, good afternoon to you.
How's it going, all right?
Yeah, you're in Portlaoise prison at
I'm
the moment.
I'm in Portlaoise, yeah, there's only one place I can be. Paul Williams knows that very well.
Okay, take your time now, John. Okay. So you're denying that you threatened to kill Adam Bradley?
The date, it was over in the Herald a week before Williams over in the Sunday World. You check that date in that Herald, and you check this prison of when that Alan Bradley sent me a postcard that very same day. How's it go?
So Daly was another really out of control psychopath and had several murders or scalps under his belt as well. And he was part of a clique of criminals that were up in Finglas and would have played and been part of the greater or the larger Marlow Hyland scene and would have associated with Dunne. But Daly in himself was considered to be, you know, he's a liability. He's too volatile. And the person he was going to target was Eamon Dunne, because Eamon Dunne had whacked a few of his friends. So Eamon Dunne, that was very much the law of the jungle, is kill or be killed. Daly was only out of prison, I can't remember how long, it was several months after he'd been on Liveline, but say 6 months, he got out of prison. I think it was this September. And he was dead within 2 months.
Wow.
Yeah, they did wasted no time. But yeah. In fairness, Daly again was very much epitomised that really nasty, volatile, brutal, psychotic type of individual that Gangland has produced, and all his associates were, a lot of them were twisted.
You've spoken to us about the murders that Dunn was responsible for and all these kind of like interpersonal dramas between him and his rivals, but I'm interested in the kind of the day-to-day business.
Dunn would have took over the mantle from Marlowe, and Marlowe was the biggest in the country. Marlowe was, as I said, you know, as we talked before, Marlowe was the go-to guy, and he was the guy who had new innovations because he wanted to make it into big National Crime Inc. But he just took over. And remember, the business of organized crime and drugs, it's not a personality contest. You have to be very, very ruthless and very, very dangerous. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about getting the product to market and increasing your market share. And for a while, it doesn't matter who you kill in the eyes of the suppliers like the Kinnans and these people, as long as business is done and it doesn't get interfered. But when you start killing too many people, the old story is the police start getting involved. Mm. And the same thing happened with the Kinnan gang, that they brought the heat on themselves, and the Byrne gang. They're all now in the nick in prison because of what they did. Murder. It's not so much the drug trafficking. It's when they start killing people that the state must respond.
And when you're describing there the moment where someone is too violent, they're attracting too much attention, that they actually become a problem and just need to be kind of gotten rid of, what do you think was that moment for Dunn?
Many. There were many. Eamon Kelly, who was the big godfather for many, many decades in Ireland and in Dublin, he was the guy who acted as godfather and mentor to young Jerry Hutch. And he also took on Dunn under his wing. Now, Dunn then went and recruited, when they came out of prison, the likes of Desi O'Hare, the Border Fox. He was associated with Declan Whacker Duffy from the INLA, another nut job and lunatic and very dangerous man. I think it was when he started threatening people, like he threatened Noel Duggan. He was known as Kingside. He was a very close friend of Jerry Hutch, best friend of Jerry Hutch, and was murdered himself during the Hutch-Kinahan feud thing. And he was an innocent man as well. He wasn't really involved in any of the shenanigans that caused all of that. He started issuing death threats to people. And because Kelly was the big godfather and was respected, a man of respect, he was the guy who could negotiate with him, say, look, I'll deal with him. And he would give him advice. But in the end, Kelly decided, I can't control this guy anymore. So when Jerry Hutch is on the phone to him, and Noel Duggan's on the phone to him, and Christy Kinahan and Daniel Kinahan are ringing up, and Liam Byrne is over in Crumlin ringing, and Hatchet Cavan is over, and they're all ringing saying, what in the name of God are you doing with this guy? Because he's threatening everybody. They say, oh, look, it's just too much hassle. And you know, for ordinary, decent human beings, this sounds like incredible, and it sounds like a script from a gangster movie, but the truth is stranger than fiction. That's how they operate. They just say, like Tony Soprano had a great line, you know, somebody's a problem, and he goes, he has to go. I heard Jerry Hutch saying that when he was during the Regency, the tapes played during the Regency trial. You know, Jerry Hutch says about 4 or 5 times, they have to go. And these were the hitmen who murdered his brother and his friends when they were talking about settling the business. It's a term to use. And they have to go means that, you know, if you become a problem, you don't get your P45, you don't get sacked, you don't get moved off the board with a big handshake. You end up dead. And if you're lucky, you'll end up dead where everyone can find your body and you can have, your family can have a funeral for you. Or like so many other guys, you just end up dead and no one ever finds you again.
And this is obviously like a pattern. I'm conscious that if you're someone like Dunn, you must be aware that this moment is probably coming for you if you fall out of favour and you're seen as being a burden. Was he getting paranoid before he died?
Oh, totally. Like he killed at least 3 or 4 people, including the guy you mentioned, you know, Gary McNally is on his best mates, purely out of paranoia. He was completely out of control. Like, he was a naturally born killer.
Yeah.
And he was a naturally born, dangerous, volatile individual by any standards. But he did expect, by the way, to die. Late in 2009, and which clearly indicates that he knew the Grim Reaper was marching in his direction, pointing a spindly finger at him. He organised his own, and it was the first of the mafia-style funerals, you know, the David Byrne funeral, which took place after the Kinnan Hutch feud blew up at the Regency. Everyone was shocked by the opulence of it and the cheek and the bravado and the display of gangland thuggery. But this guy, Dunn, was way ahead of the posse on this one. Like, he booked an undertaker and he ordered an aluminium casket from the US, which arrived in Ireland in February 2010, just about 2 months before he was murdered himself. And he also picked his own grave in Dardistown Cemetery in North Dublin and left instructions that he wanted to be buried head to head with his friend and fellow killer, Paddy Doyle. Paddy Doyle was a notorious hitman. He came to prominence during the Crumlin and Drimna feud, and he remained a hitman. And in the end, Gary Hutch and other associates in the Kinahan gang, under the orders of Daniel Kinahan, murdered Paddy Doyle, because Paddy Doyle was a hitman who was too enthusiastic about his work, just like Eamon Dunn. And why was he whacked? He was whacked because he became a nuisance and he was a danger to everybody. So that was quite an extraordinary thing. Like, he left very, very strict instructions that he was to be laid out in this casket in his parents' home, and he even specified the clothes that he would wear, and he specified the dress code for his henchmen and the friends: black ties, shorts and suits. And he also asked that they take turns carrying his casket to the local church. Now, that was an extraordinary display, and it was also brilliant for us at the time as crime journalists, because we could get loads of photographs of all the criminal thuggery, all the main players at the time. And even in his death, he was paranoid, because he was afraid of attack, but he was also afraid of further media exposure. And he was so determined that nobody could get a photograph of him in the coffin that he insisted that no mobile phones, all mobile phones were to be banned. Nobody was going to get within yards of him with any device that could record a picture. And I suppose the irony is that he more than just predicted his own death, he planned for his own death.
So it obviously would have come as no surprise to anybody, including Dunn himself, that in the months after he was making all of these preparations for his own death, he was shot.
Yeah, on Friday, the 23rd of April, 2010, he was sitting in a pub with members of his family and was enjoying a few drinks when no one associates of the Kinahan organisation and the Hutch organisation walked in and shot him dead. And it was, without the need to exaggerate in any shape, make, or form, it was one of those major, major gangland stories of the past 10, 20 years. It was a big event. This guy had become so big. And of course, the public hadn't been introduced to Eamon Dunn. All we could do is run pictures of him and black out his eyes. And I put the nickname on him, the Don, and described him as closely as I could, which used to really drive him insane as well, because he was massively paranoid about the media as well. So they walked in, they shot him dead. It was a very well organised hit. The police know who did it. Of course, there's the issue of evidence. They just didn't have enough evidence to charge them. But they knew who was involved. And it was the central core of the Kinahan organisation, because this committee, this ad hoc, unofficial committee, the Code of Ethics Brigade within gangland, decided he was to go, and that was it.
I think there was some detail at the time of him trying to use somebody as a human shield. Was that right?
Yeah, he went to dash behind somebody else, like they all do. I suppose it's a natural
instinct. Well,
remember, he was a coward. He was clearly expecting to be shot.
A young accountancy student, Zhen Tiang was his name. He was a Chinese lounge attendant. He said he was serving in the pub that night. There was a statement read from him. He has since gone back to China. But in that statement, he said he was waiting there to be paid for a round of drinks when Eamon Dunn suddenly grabbed him. Now, he said he thought it was a joke at the time, but he said that Dunn had tried to hide himself, use him as a shield before he heard the shots. And then he realised something was wrong. People were screaming and panicking, and he ran and hid in the ladies' toilets.
He clearly knew that he had a limited period of time left in his life. So he wouldn't give a shit about who he
took down with him.
He'd have no problem sheltering behind you and for you to take the bullets. You know, these guys have just, there's nothing there. They're just empty creatures. They're just entities, really, rather than human beings, if you really, really want to get into the psyche of these people. They don't care for anybody or anything. They might care about their mammies and daddies and stuff like that. But after that, everybody else is just fair game. They're classic, classic psychopaths.
You've spoken us through all of these figures and, you know, the mechanics of the succession process in the crime world. And I'm conscious that nature abhors a vacuum, and maybe crime does as well. And when you have all these big personalities, these people with kind of psychotic tendencies for violence, I feel like at the end of the day, the crime world will make sure that they're replaceable, that no matter how big someone is, when their end inevitably comes, when they become too much of a problem for the people around them, it seems like somebody else will always take their place.
It's self-preservation. It's how that world preserves itself. Like using the white blood cells in the body, I suppose, is the best example of that. But they just don't do it the way normal people would do it. You know, you don't get sacked. So it is an inevitable consequence. And like, that's the whole thing, that every major criminal that I have ever written about, and all the books I've written, and so many of them I've covered over the past 30-odd years or so, there is a predictability about their life stories. And all you could do, there is a template to their stories. And that is that you have a young bit of a thug on the streets, gets involved in crime, gets gradually more involved in more serious crime, has certain qualities that differentiate him from the rest of the mob or the pack, and he emerges as a leader as time goes on. And then they have to maintain, on the way up, they have to get rid of people. Or else on the way up, and they don't get rid of people, when they get to the top, they have to get rid of people. And on the way down, they have to try and get rid of people. And ultimately, they end up, some of the major players, the average is about 4, 5, 6 years, like a flame. They'll reach their brilliance for a while and then they will just fade. And they will either end up being arrested and put in prison, where they will then go to prison and plan the next big job, which are not going to get caught the next time when they come out, because they're going to be even more wiser, which of course is nonsense. Or else they end up dead. They're the only two alternatives. That is why it's easy for us to write the stories about these people, because we know what's going to happen to them. When John Gilligan came out of prison, thought he was going to throw his weight around, bully everybody. Like, that idiot. He went around and the world had changed. He'd been away for over 20 years. And the Kennans and their associates sent hitmen to tell him and show him that he was no longer the big godfather. And they shot him, and it was just a miracle that he actually survived. And he didn't learn his lesson there.
My thanks to Paul Williams. I'm Ellen Coyne, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Ian Doyle, researched by Dave Hanratty, with sound by John Smith. Archive clips from RTE News and the Irish Independent. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to follow and leave us a review.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920, there's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.